Series on Sunday mornings just now is entitled The Exalted Christ. We've seen together that the exalted Christ is sovereign, the exalted Christ is incarnate, the exalted Christ is redeemer, the exalted Christ is accompanied, the exalted Christ is near. This morning in our penultimate study in this series, our title is The Exalted Christ is Undefeatable. The Exalted Christ is Undefeatable. And if the Exalted Christ is Accompanied was the least self-explanatory title in the series, The Exalted Christ is Undefeatable is probably the most self-explanatory title. It means exactly what you're all thinking that it means. It means that Christ, having been exalted, simply cannot be defeated. That possibility just does not exist. But I guess you'd feel a bit shortchanged if I ended the sermon now, after only about 45 seconds or something. So even though the undefeatableness of the exalted Christ is not a novel theme and it's not a complicated theme, I am going to develop it this morning, and I'm going to do so under three headings. And first of all then, a diverted serpent. A diverted serpent. And hearing that first heading, some of you will already, I guess, be turning to the passage that we read earlier, the first passage that we read, Revelation chapter 12, and rightly so. We are indeed going to spend the first few minutes of our sermon camped there. Revelation 12 is not a passage that we've been to yet in this series, but it does contain a description of Christ's exaltation. It contains a description of Christ's exaltation that is perhaps the most understated of any that you'll find in the New Testament, and yet that is at the same time, paradoxically, perhaps the most dramatic of any that you will find in the New Testament. It's in verse 5 of Revelation 12. Now, the verse speaks of Christ's birth. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. It then skips over his entire life and death and describes his exaltation, but it does so in such a stripped down, unadorned way that you could almost miss it. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. You see what I mean about it being understated? I mean, compare Ephesians 1, 20 and 21, talking about the same event. God raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. That's rousing, isn't it? That's stirring, that gets your juices flowing as you hear it read. The description in Revelation 12:5, on the other hand, it's like the classified football results on the radio on a Saturday evening. Your team's victory that Saturday afternoon might have been amazing. You might have beaten the team that's top of the league. The winning goal might have been an absolute screamer from 30 yards out. The atmosphere in the stadium might have been out of this world. But the result will be announced in those classified football results in the most matter-of-fact way, won't it? And it's similarly in the most matter-of-fact way that Christ's exaltation is announced here, caught up to God and to his throne. That's it. Just eight simple little words. So it's understated, all right, but why am I also saying then that it's dramatic? Well, because within the flow of Revelation chapter 12, it changes everything. It changes everything. Those eight simple little words are the pivotal moment in the entire chapter. Let me show you what I mean. Now, a key character in Revelation 12 is clearly this fierce predator whom we encounter there, at some points referred to as a dragon, and at some points referred to as a serpent. This character is Satan. We are told that quite explicitly in verse 9. And in the first part of the chapter then, the predator targets Christ. Christ is the one Satan desires as his prey. This woman to whom we're introduced in the opening verse, she's the people of God. And she's pregnant, verse 2, with Christ. Christ is going to come from God's people, the seed of Abraham, the son of David, the line of the tribe of Judah. For all those centuries of Old Testament history, he is, as it were, within her womb. And so, in the first half of verse 4 then, the dragon, Satan, assaults the woman, the people of God. He's trying to prevent her giving birth. And he does damage her. The swipes of his tail mangle her beautiful crown with its 12 stars. In real terms, God's people are bashed around as the Egyptians enslave them for 400 years, and as the Babylonians come and destroy their temple and their monarchy, and as Haman the Agagite plans their annihilation, and so it goes on. And it's all Satan attempting to abort Christ, attempting to ensure that Christ never sees the light of day. But he doesn't succeed. Which means that in the second half of verse 4, the dragon has to move to plan B. He has to eliminate Christ as soon as the woman has delivered her child. In real terms, that's the infant Jesus being hunted by Herod following the visit of the Magi. But behind Herod, it's Satan then, determined to nip the newborn Christ in the bud before he has achieved anything. But again, he doesn't succeed. And instead, the moment comes there in verse 5 when Christ is caught up to God and to his throne. And as I said a moment ago, that changes everything. Because Satan does not at that point move to plan C. Okay, I failed to stop Christ being born. And him having been born, I failed to stop him being caught up to God and to his throne. I'm just going to have to do this thing the hard way. I'm going to have to pull him off that throne there in heaven. I'm going to have to de-exalt him. It's not ideal. It's a shame it's come to this. It's not the nice, clean way I'd hoped to deal with him. But hey-ho, a dragon's got to do what a dragon's got to do. Plan C, Operation Dethrone Christ, must now be launched. No, he doesn't say that. It's too late for that. With the exaltation of Christ, I'm saying, a line has been crossed. The game's up for Satan. Satan has missed his window of opportunity. If he was going to get Christ, it had to be in one of those earlier phases. He ain't going to get him once Christ is enthroned. There in the presence of God, Christ's enthronement cannot be reversed. It cannot be undone. It puts him in an utterly unassailable, altogether untouchable position. He is undefeatable now. So, if the game's up for Satan, if there's no plan C, if he's lost out on the prey that he so desperately wanted and so desperately needed, if there's no way back for him, no way he can now turn the situation around, what happens to Satan? Does he just shuffle away, never to be heard of again? Well, let's follow the flow of the passage. So notice in the next verse, verse 6, it describes the woman, that is God's people, remember, fleeing. The passage then contains an interlude, a long interlude. The focus shifts in verse 7 to heaven and the implications there of Christ's exaltation. And it's fascinating and rich material, but we haven't time to get into that this morning. But with verse 12, the interlude ends. Verse 13 picks up where verse 6 had left off. It takes us back to the situation of the woman, God's people on earth following Christ's exaltation. And it depicts Satan going after her, going after the people of God. It's the phenomenon that we usually call persecution. And there's an interesting emphasis on divine protection in verses 13 to 16. The woman is given wings, verse 14. She's nourished, verse 14 again. The earth comes to her help, verse 16. Satan actually isn't enjoying any more success against her than he had previously enjoyed against Christ. But it's the very fact that he is pursuing her at all that is the main point here. Do you see this? He's pursuing God's people because he can't pursue Christ now. Christ was his target. Christ was his intended prey. But Christ is no longer within his reach. And God's people are all he's got left to chase after. That's what I mean by a diverted serpent. Christ's exaltation has diverted him from what he really wants to be doing but can't now do, getting Christ. It's diverted him from that to doing the one thing that's still open to him, attacking God's people. And there's something important here then in terms of our outlook. We live in a world today, don't we, in which the Church of Jesus Christ suffers more than ever. You can't get your head around the scale of the persecution of the Church of Jesus Christ in our world today. And I'm very conscious then that we here in the UK are presently spared that persecution that the church in most places is enduring. And it's very easy, therefore, for us to say grand-sounding things about the whole phenomenon. We're not homeless, we're not in prison, we're not hated by everyone in our village. As I say, it's easy for us to theologize grandly from our comfortable armchairs. Nevertheless, I think we do need to put the widespread persecution of God's people into a biblical perspective. You see, we might think that the prevalence of persecution is an indication of Satan's strength. It seems a natural, logical inference, doesn't it? There's persecution going on in all these different parts of the world. We know that Satan is behind it. It's an indication, therefore, of how well he's doing, how well things are going for him. Our passage, however, says the prevalence of persecution is in fact the opposite. It actually indicates the very opposite of that. Imagine you go to the zoo and you go to the lion's enclosure. And for a few minutes you watch a lion playing with a ball that's there in the enclosure to keep the lion occupied, or some kind of plastic toy or something that's in there. And the lion then, it's pouncing on that thing. And with your phone, you manage to get a picture of the lion mid-pounce. And as you look at that image later, what sort of scene does it show? Well, I suppose you could say it's a highly impressive scene. This great beast with its piercing eyes and formidable physique, every sinew in its body straining as it leaps through the air, you could say it's highly impressive. But actually, it's a pathetic scene, isn't it? Because a lion doesn't really want to be pouncing on a silly, inanimate, inedible plastic toy. It will do so if that's all it's got, because it can't get rid of those predatorial instincts. But it really wants to be pouncing on gazelles and things like that. And the spectacle in our world today of Satan pouncing on the church is a bit like that. It's not an indication of his strength. It's actually a pathetic scene, because he doesn't really want to be pouncing on the church. He wants to be pouncing on Jesus Christ himself. But this is what the once ambitious serpent who was going to eliminate God's Messiah, this is what he has been reduced to. This is all he has left, because Christ's exaltation has put him hopelessly out of his reach. I'm saying everything that you read about in the literature from Barnabas Fund and from Open Doors, it doesn't scream out, "Mighty Satan." It screams out, "Undefeatable Christ." It points to a pitifully diverted serpent who now has to settle for hurting the church because he has failed, decisively and irreversibly failed to get the better of Christ. His campaign against the church in these last days is an admission that he's lost. It's an admission that he has lost. A diverted serpents. But then notice with me, secondly, this morning, a defiant stance. A defiant stance. So I said just now that we in the UK are presently spared persecution, and that's true, of course, but it's not to say that as we look out this morning at the scene around us, everything is hunky-dory. Niall McRae is an author and journalist. He's not a Christian. But he wrote a sobering little article the other day about going back recently to the town that he grew up in, Greenock, a former shipbuilding place just where the River Clyde deepens into the Firth of Clyde. And listen then to what Niall McRae writes. He says, "A stark illustration of the withdrawing tide of Christian worship is in Greenock, to the west of Glasgow. Driving eastward along Union Street, an impressive range of ecclesiastical buildings comes into view. The lofty tower of St. George's North, built in 1870, pierces the horizon, looming over neighbouring churches around George Square. It's a timeless scene, unchanged from my childhood when I was taken to Methodist Sunday school. But look closer today, and the faithful foundation, ranging from Gothic splendour to ascetic simplicity, is in terminal decline." He continues, "The reason for my visit was the passing of my father. His will specified the Methodist church for his funeral, but on a Sunday morning I found it closed for business. Nearby, a kirk of the Church of Scotland, of similar design to St. Martin in the Fields at Trafalgar Square, had reduced its operations to an adjacent hall. At George Square, St. George's North was shut a long time ago and is now used for martial arts. The Baptist chapel on the square was converted to a gym. At least two churches were deployed as furniture warehouses. I was on a mission seeking a suitable substitute for the Methodists to do my father's funeral. Parking near George Square, we could hear an organ playing and entered St. John's Episcopal Church, a service with populated pews. My mother, younger brother and I stayed. Two immigrant families were among the gathering, perhaps giving some hope for the future of Christianity. The others were all elderly." And he concludes, "With the possible exception of its Catholic inhabitants, Greenock is losing its religion. When we left the church, the street was deserted. When I was young, the numerous churches in the vicinity of our Gowan Street and George Square often caused traffic jams on a Sunday. In that lost world, ladies wore posh coats and hats, and gents wore jacket and tie." And the same sort of thing then that he wrote of Greenock there could be written of virtually any town, couldn't it? In Scotland or in England or in Wales in 2023. And of course, we're not just living in a society of empty church buildings. It's also a society that has legalized same-sex marriage. A society in which in every secondary school, there are boys and girls changing the pronouns by which they wish to be known. And so we could go on and on. And how, as evangelical Christians, do we respond to this situation then? The withdrawing tide of Christian worship, as that non-Christian described it. Well, I suspect often in one of two ways we respond. So one response is a siege mentality, in which we tear our hair out and cry with Private Fraser in Dad's Army, "We are doomed, we are doomed." And we become convinced that things are so bad that the end must be just around the corner. That's one response that perhaps we're inclined to. The other response is to go into problem-solving mode. Okay, we just need to plant more churches. Get Christianity out there in the public square. Compete in the marketplace of ideas. Get Franklin Graham over to conduct a mega tour of our towns and cities. Fight back and regain the lost ground. But both those responses, I would put it to you this morning, are unsatisfactory. I mean, if anyone might have been tempted to retreat into a siege mentality, it was John, the author of this book of Revelation. I mean, things for him were really bad, really, really bad. He would have laughed, wouldn't he, at us crying, "We are doomed," because of our empty church buildings and same-sex marriage and inaccurate pronouns. What, he would have said? So no one's been forced to worship the emperor. No one's been imprisoned on a rocky island out at sea like I am. No one's been killed for their Christian faith. What have you got to worry about? John would have said. And if anyone then might have been tempted, as I say, to retreat into the siege mentality, it's John at that particular point. Things were so, so desperately grim. But as the Spirit of God gives John this series of visions throughout this book of Revelation, what's their gist? John, you need to tear your hair out, mate. Or at least hold some pretty intense prayer meetings for revival. Things are very desperate, John. No, that's not the gist. The gist of the book of Revelation is this. John, you need to realize that Christ is on the throne and he is undefeatable. That's Revelation in one sentence. Christ is on the throne and he is undefeatable. And those of us then who are inclined toward the siege mentality, we need to realize that too. That Christ is on the throne and he is undefeatable. As for the problem-solving mode that perhaps others of us are inclined toward, I like these words from Doug Wilson. Doug Wilson is a Presbyterian pastor and theologian in the United States, and he's often quite provocative, and perhaps a little provocative even here, but these, I think, are very insightful words when he says, "The problem with North American evangelicals is that we're treating evangelism as though it were a presidential campaign, instead of the announcement of a coronation that happened 2,000 years ago." He continues, "We want to get enough people to vote for Jesus, and then maybe we can turn this thing around. What we should be doing is this. Preachers should be going into the pulpit announcing it has already been turned around. It's already completed. It's already done. Come quietly." I'm saying then that in these circumstances in which you and I find ourselves, we should neither be lamenting the demise of Christianity on the one hand, nor plotting some clever strategy for its recovery on the other hand. Rather, we should have this defiant stance. Christ is exalted. He's on the throne. He's undefeatable. Whatever may be happening in Greenock today, whatever may be happening in Newcastle, whatever may be happening in all our towns and cities and villages, none of that remotely alters the fact. Jesus is exalted and he's undefeatable, therefore. I wonder, how do you see these gatherings that we have on a Sunday? Perhaps you see them a little bit like the gatherings of war veterans that will be happening up and down our land today. Fewer and fewer of us as the years go by. We're a relic of a now bygone era, and it's nice to meet together while some of us are still left. Perhaps that's how you regard Christian gatherings on a Sunday. That's the siege mentality outlook. Or perhaps you regard them as a kind of Just Stop Oil protest gathering. And by meeting then, we're protesting the culture around us and hoping that people will take notice of us. That's the problem-solving outlook. We should view these gatherings in neither of those ways. Here's a better analogy. We are like the Newcastle United fans at Chelsea for the final game of last season. At any given point during that game, irrespective of what was happening on the pitch in front of them, the fans were singing their heart out. Why? Well, because their team had already secured Champions League status the week before and couldn't lose it. And they were celebrating that, irrespective of what was happening in that game in front of them. And irrespective then of what is happening in front of us in our society today, irrespective of those crumbling, empty buildings lining the streets of Greenock, irrespective of church-going statistics, irrespective of legislation that's passing through Parliament, Christ has already taken the throne and he cannot lose it. We gather to celebrate that every Sunday. To hear the preacher in different ways from different parts of the Bible announce to us again each week, Christ is on the throne. And to sing our hearts out in celebration of it. You know, throughout the Bible, God's people sing because a victory has been won. You go back to the Red Sea, and there they are on the banks of the Red Sea, and they're singing in Exodus 15 because a victory has been won over the Egyptians. You go to Judges chapter 5, and Barak and Deborah are creating that wonderful song, and it's because a victory has been won over the Canaanites. You think of the women coming out of the towns as David returned from crushing the Philistine. A victory has been won, and they are singing songs in the Bible nearly always. When God's people are singing them, are triggered by victories, and that's why we sing. That's why we sing when we gather here on a Sunday. Because Christ is on the throne, he's exalted, and he's utterly, utterly undefeatable. Forgive me, just one more football-related illustration. Imagine you're a football fan there, and let's say a Manchester United fan, and Manchester United are playing Arsenal at Old Trafford. And you put the radio on, you're in your car, you put the radio on just after the final whistle, you don't know the score. And the commentator is recapping the game as you put the radio on, and he's not announcing the score, but you don't need to hear him out until he has announced the score. You know immediately everything you need to know, and your heart sinks. How come? Well, in the background, you can hear the Arsenal fans singing. And if they are singing, if the little 3,000 or 4,000 group of Arsenal fans at Old Trafford are singing, it means you've lost. Simple as that. And you know, Satan and all the demons have that heart-sinking experience every Sunday. Because from thousands of Christian churches all over the world, they hear the sound of singing. And it's just rubbed into them that little bit more. If they are singing, it means we've lost. That's why there's no excuse for half-hearted singing in our congregation on a Sunday. We are singing in the face of the watching demons. We are shouting at them, you've lost. Christ has won. He's on the throne. You can't pull him down from there. He is undefeatable. Let's shout it. Shout it in their faces. Let's have this defiant stance, I'm saying. In 2023, as we perhaps feel that everything is crumbling around us as Christians, let's have this defiant stance of men and women who know that their king is exalted and his kingdom cannot fail and no one can dislodge him from his throne. Let's have that confidence coursing through our veins, an undefeatable Christ. So we've seen then a diverted serpent, a defiant stance, but then thirdly and finally this morning, a disastrous slogan. A disastrous slogan. Perhaps some of you in this room this morning are not Christians. You don't acknowledge Jesus Christ to be your Lord and your Saviour. I just want to go back again to that quote I read you from Doug Wilson a few minutes ago. And I want to say again then, as he says there, that Jesus is not running in some campaign and trying to get your vote. He is not running in some campaign and trying to get your vote. If that were the case, if this was some huge democratic business going on, and Jesus was a candidate seeking votes, then you would be perfectly entitled to refuse him your vote and say, I don't want you ruling over me, thank you very much, Jesus Christ. And if there were enough people with the same view as you, then you would be able to stop him ever gaining any power. That's how democracy works. But that's not the case here, you see. Jesus has already gained the power. He's on the throne. And it doesn't matter then how vehemently you shout that slogan, I don't want you ruling over me, Jesus Christ. It doesn't matter how many people shout it, he's undefeatable. Which means then that actually the slogan isn't just silly and futile and a waste of breath, but it's disastrous. It's disastrous. If Christ is on the throne, then it's not merely the case that you aren't going to dislodge him. It's the case that you'd better jolly well make sure you submit to him. And this then comes across, doesn't it, in that other passage that we read this morning, that parable of Jesus in Luke chapter 19. That parable begins with Jesus' exaltation. We're told of this nobleman in verse 12 of Luke 19 who went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom. That's Christ going up to heaven at the end of his mission on earth. That's his exaltation, going there to receive a kingdom before he one day returns again. And of course, the main storyline then in this parable that Jesus tells there is about these servants of his, these 10 servants of his, and it goes into some length then about them. But there's a subplot, isn't there? There's a subplot in this parable. Verse 14, his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, "We do not want this man to reign over us." And it seems a very arbitrary, random little insertion there into the story, because it then disappears as soon as it's appeared. But actually it suddenly reappears, doesn't it? This subplot at the end, right at the very end, verse 27. "As for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me." And so I say again this morning, to shout, "I don't want you reigning over me, Jesus," at a Jesus who is seeking your vote, that's one thing. But there is no such Jesus. The only Jesus that there is needs no votes, because he is on the throne. And he is coming back one day to allocate to every man and woman and boy and girl their eternal, everlasting destiny. Which means that if I were you, I wouldn't continue another day. I wouldn't continue another hour saying that slogan, "I don't want you reigning over me, thank you very much, Jesus Christ." In actual fact, it's the best thing in the world, you know, having Jesus reigning over you. And many in this room could tell you that. And if I were preaching on another passage this morning, that might be the emphasis that I brought out. The loveliness of being under the benevolent reign of King Jesus Christ. But this morning, I want to take this more robust approach. And I want to insist that Christ is on the throne. And Christ is therefore undefeatable. You cannot cast him off his throne, but he can cast you into hell. If I were you, in Douglas Wilson's words, I would come quietly. I would submit this morning. I would surrender this morning and say, "Lord Jesus, do rule over me. King of my life, I crown thee now. Make your peace with this undefeatable Lord of heaven and earth while you still have the chance to do that before that terrible day comes when he returns as king, victorious, to cast all his enemies into everlasting fire. This morning, make your peace with him. Amen.